This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik, and my co-host for the Doctor in House segment, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, in the studio with me today. It is 2 years after what was declared the first movement control order, the MCO, if any of us still remember that term, and all the alphabets that came after that.
Yeah, and Kasana Kasini. Do you remember
that? That's right, and Duduk Rumah.
Duduk Rumah, flattening the curve.
That's right. Yeah. So, 2 years later, in a way, it seems like it's a flash in time, but the days were also very long. Mm. And we want to look at what's happened in the last 2 years, because now we're looking at transitioning into COVID-19 being an endemic disease. Yeah. What exactly does that mean? And what do we need to do to make sure that we understand what endemic really means?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it's important to look forward, and mm-hmm. it's also important to look back, right, on reflection, last 24 months. I think it's probably good enough to get the listeners out there to get involved in the conversation. So what do you remember the most about the last 24 months? Shall we, what do you think we've done well in the last 24 months?
I think we, as a population, we really did come together very quickly, understood what we needed to do. Mm-hmm. I think I'm so impressed by our vaccination take-up rate.
Right.
And our masking, you know. You know, people
how
really
compliant we are.
That's right. We are still. You look at other countries where they had issues instituting a mask mandate, and mm-hmm. that really hasn't been a problem here. Perhaps culturally, we mm-hmm. are more accepting of it. So those two things, you know, I'm very impressed. Masking, vaccination.
And Mai Sejahtera and how compliant everyone is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mai Sejahtera has had lots of ups and downs. But yeah, in terms of people's behaviours, those two things stand out for me.
For me, I think I really have to kind of like, give a shout out to Ministry of Health. I mean, throughout the whole last 2 years, they were the one who shouldered the burden of looking after the patients. I looked at Mai Sejahtera early on the statistics, 3.9 million infected individuals later, 34,000 deaths later, and all that number of people had recovered, and it's purely 99% really nurtured by Ministry of Health. And I really think that goes without saying, because for years and years, we know that it's underfunded, understaffed, but putting up, with all that and all throughout the whole last 24 months, just an amazing job, really. Mm,
and our frontliners really are still struggling out there, to be mm-hmm. honest, right?
Yeah.
Many of us are beginning to relax, but we can't forget that in hospitals, the healthcare workers are still managing cases that do still come in.
Indeed.
Yeah, and so I always have that in the back of my mind as well, what they are going through. And, George, you and I are not talking about this alone today.
Absolutely.
We have joining us on the line public health medicine specialist, Assistant Professor Dr. Farhan Rusli. And we will be getting his thoughts from a policy perspective. What have we learned from the last 2 years? What can we do to look forward?
Mm-hmm.
But as George said, do text us with your thoughts. You know, what do you remember of the last 24 months? What sticks out to you? And, you know, do you think we're prepared to handle endemicity? You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Dr. Farhan, thanks for staying on the line. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Well, I think George will have this joke that I'm the least optimistic person in the room when it comes to how we're faring in terms of the pandemic.
She even has a term for that. It says a realistic optimism,
yes.
Right? Yeah. Well, I'm just optimistic optimism, really. So, okay, for me, it's constantly from day one, hoping that the border will be open and that sort of thing. And it's not too far away from it now, right? Farhan, what do you remember the most? I mean, what do you think we've done best out of the last 24 months? And what do you think is the worst thing that we've done?
I think one of the best things that we've done as a people is that no matter what happened on the political scale, we all actually maintain our cool and we actually did what we can with the things that we had, because the journey has not been easy. The turmoil of politics and the landscape of changing of health ministers 3 times mm-hmm. does not actually really benefit the people on the ground. But I think over the past the people that actually work.
Dr. Farhan, we're losing you a little bit. Could I get you to just repeat?
Oh. Okay. Well, from what I gathered, he was saying that it's obviously people got together. We must not forget that there were a little bit of political upheaval and then
who
also incident. That's right.
Mm.
And then, you know, that is probably the worst combination when it comes to a crisis. It is a health crisis and political crisis. And he said that, you know, we pulled through despite three health ministers, but we had a very solid key person,
absolutely,
you know, Dato' Hisham, or at that time, Dato' Hisham, obviously Tan Sri now, well-deserving. And do you remember that time was voted one of the three top clinicians that can actually lead the nation out of that trouble. So it's an amazing thing, right? Dr. Farhan, I know you're back online now. We heard what you said about obviously that political turmoil that you know, the nation got together and managed to pull through that, and it shows our resilience as Malaysians. Is that what you have in mind?
Yes, because you see people like Melinda, because I was close to her. She actually managed to get all these people who knew how to sew, and the sailors, this group of sailors, to actually make PPEs when none of the countries were actually exporting to our country. And then we had people who started donating, and we had cafeterias, and those people who were caterers, cooking food for the people. I think this is the thing that we have to look at, is that regardless of whatever happens, is that if the country pulls together as a nation, regardless of race, religion, and we put all of those things aside, I think that's the best thing that I can actually remember over the past 24 months.
Mm-hmm. Anything that we didn't do so well, you reckon?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, overall, the world was just learning about something that was absolutely new. I think this should serve as a lesson, because I think we were never an independent nation when other countries like the Americans or the British, they went through the Spanish flu, so they had an idea of what the pandemic was like. I mean, we did not have that chance. I mean, we just had like small scares like H1N1, MERS-CoV, but we didn't have a full-blown pandemic that we could learn from.
Yeah.
And I think the pandemic actually showed cracks or revealed cracks that were actually already present. And I think moving forward, we have to see what should we invest in and what are the things that we should actually do to make sure that our public health infrastructure is actually ready for the next pandemic when it comes.
Yeah, Dr. Farhan, I totally agree with you that I thought in my own reflection, I thought we had three cracks. Number one, I think there's a rich-poor divide in the nation. It's simply something that is something that needs to be addressed, because the COVID itself opened up that cracks so obviously for a lot of us. The second thing which I thought was very important was that just before the pandemic, we actually have the National Health and Morbidity Survey highlighting the non-communicable diseases were such in an alarming state. And then that just came out and then showing that how many people succumb to the illness because of non-communicable diseases. I really think as a nation, we really need to reflect on that, because if we have another wave of any disease, really want to keep the nation fit and healthy. And lastly, like you said, that, you know, that sort of like eventually, although we have our differences, that cracks itself really was quite minor. Eventually, it healed together when we face a crisis with such resilience.
What are your thoughts on the cracks, Dr. Farhan?
Well, I think what George mentioned for point number two was pretty good, because you see the pandemic, if you look at the statistics of the people who have passed away tragically due to COVID, we see that the majority of them are those people who actually have heart disease, they have kidney failure, they have obesity, they have diabetes and all these things. So it actually highlights a bigger issue that we are facing in the country, is that a lot of our people are actually unhealthy. And we see that unhealthy people, whenever they are faced with certain things, they do much worse. And the sad thing is that the majority of these people are those in the lower income group. So it highlights further the difference in the nutritional status, the access to quality, good and cheap food. And as you can see, the people who are much more richer, or the economic status is much more higher, actually much more better in the pandemic compared to those who are at the lower bottom tier. And this is something where we have to look at it from a bird's eye view, that the process actually does not only involve health, it involves economy, it involves our family matters. It's actually a very, very meticulous things where there's a lot of things that you have to look into for you to overcome these cracks that George has also pointed out.
So I think the other thing that really stood out for me in the last 2 years that was that really determined and influenced how people behaved, what we knew of the situation, was communication, risk communication, and communication about strategies that needed to be taken. What are your thoughts on how that fared in the last 2 years? Dr. Farhan?
Yeah, sorry, I didn't quite catch you. Did you repeat the last one?
Sorry, yeah. What struck me in the last 2 years, apart from the status of our population's health, apart from how we were able to deal with COVID, was communications of public health strategies that came from the authorities and needed to be translated into behaviours among the public. What were your thoughts on how we fared in terms of risk communication in the last 2 years?
Well, I think up until about 2 months ago, our risk communication was in big fat F. I'm very sorry to say it, but we have to say things as they are. I mean, you have to call a spade, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were times when I think what politicians need to understand is this, is that at times of crises, they are actually what people look at or people look to give them the right and accurate information so that they are actually prepared about what's happening. They're not panicked. So the risk communication aspect was little to none existent up to a certain point. They had so many miscommunication. And at times, they gave too much scientific information to people,
mm-hmm.
That people were not unable to translate into what was on the ground. That's why you had people who were working in the night markets, people who were in the lower socioeconomic divide. They couldn't grasp why the whole PKP or the movement control order was actually enforced. They thought that it was just oppressing them from doing their work and all these things. So that's why I think in the beginning, people could not understand what were the government's initiatives, and people could not see the response. But to the untrained eye, there was actually a lot of things that were going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it was just not communicated to the people. People did not see.
I agree with you.
Yeah. The divide actually happened.
Shall we? Probably in the beginning, there were too many people participating in it. And then later on, you know, like what Farhana was saying, that last 2-3 months, and then perhaps we have KJ kind of like integrated all that information together, then everything became consolidated.
All right. Well, you know, sorry, Dr. Farhan, would you like to add?
Yeah. I think what's important there is for us to look at this, right? So KJ himself, he's not a medical doctor. So a lot of people question whether you should actually have a medical doctor to be a health minister. But when you are facing certain crises going on, you should understand that it's not only about having the background of medicine, but rather you should also have the finesse of actually communicating things to the people. And this is something that is really important. It's not just about being smart enough. It's also about having the zest to information on to people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think what we saw was, whether or not our ministers are, medical doctors, what we saw was the civil service, right? We have a Ministry of Health, we have a Director General, and they act as advisors in terms of crafting policies and advising in terms of communications. But I think what I would like to do is to look at our plan to transition to endemicity, and what we need to learn, and I think really to clarify what's in people's minds, does endemicity mean it's harmless? What do we still need to do moving forward? How do we ensure that we don't see, other countries are doing different things? What will work for us? That's what I'd like to find out when we come back from the break. My co-host in the studio with me, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and we're speaking to Assistant Professor Dr. Farhan Rusli, public health medicine specialist. It is the so-called second year anniversary, I guess, of what was the first movement control order 2 years ago. So everybody remembers the date, 18th of March. But, you know, what have we learned in the last 2 years? Do text us with your thoughts. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. We'll come back to continue this conversation. Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik, and my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. We're speaking to Assistant Professor Dr. Farhan Rusli, public health medicine specialist from the International Islamic University of Malaysia. We're discussing, are we ready to transition into endemicity? In a way, it feels like only 2 short years since the movement control order was declared to keep the pandemic under control. But, you know, now we're talking about mitigation instead of, you know, zero COVID, which some countries are still trying to do. Malaysia, and I think it's the right move, is not going with the zero COVID strategy. It's just not possible. So what does the transition into endemicity look like? Dr. Farhan, your immediate thoughts on some of the measures that were recently announced to take place come 1st April. Dr. Farhan. Oops, we've lost Dr. Farhan again. We'll try to get him back on.
Perhaps we'll just read out a few things about what is going to come forward in from 1st of April, right?
That's right.
Well, first of all, most exciting things that a
for
lot of
you.
Us, for me, and for many people who are itching to kind of like go out of the country, obviously, is this border restrictions being lifted. Mm-hmm. Like, so a lot of people were just wondering, right, you know, when you have one country such as somewhere like Japan and China are still doing hotel quarantine. And on the other hand, UK has lifted their last restriction today that actually tracing where your whereabouts going to be if the moment you land, it's no longer an issue. Mm. So they don't even consider COVID-19 as dangerous as a common flu. So why do we have such a big spectrum and where do we fit in that spectrum? It's a good time to actually get Dr. Farhan to make a comment about the border restrictions.
All right. Dr. Farhan, do we have you back on the line?
Yes, you do. Well, I think talking about border restrictions, right? I think what's important here for us to understand is that for me, myself, I am trying to make some sense of what does it mean when we talk about transitioning to endemicity. Are we on the 1st of April an endemic phase or are we in a pandemic phase? Because I think it's difficult for you to put us in between because you're talking about certain restrictions or all restrictions that have been lifted, except for nightclubs. I think that's one thing we can talk about. So does endemicity mean that nightclubs will be included? Is that the only difference between transitioning to endemicity and also full endemicity? Because this plays very important to when we open up our borders. Is it the right time for us to open? Absolutely. We definitely have to open.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
But the bigger question that we have to ask is our public health infrastructure from the digitalization of health, such as MySatra, the tracing, the tracking app, is it ready for the influx of people to come in to our country? Mm-hmm. Are we ready for that? That is the question that we have to ask ourselves.
Do you think we are?
I don't think so on that front. I'm really sorry to say it, but I don't think we are. We know that we've still seen that there are some issues with MySatra. I think recently I've written on how a certain hacker who absolutely had no bad intentions actually just changed his vaccination status to fully vaccinated. So there's a lot of loopholes that are still occurring on the system that we completely rely on. And for me, it's extremely worrying when we put all our eggs into one basket.
So what you're worrying is that ill individuals from abroad coming in and then that will put on a lot of strain in our country's healthcare and infect our local people and then increase a spike of infections of ill people. Do you think we will ever be ready?
Yes, of course. I think we have to understand there are two different things here, right? The first thing is infection. Infections we can control, but definitely we cannot just completely stop. But at the same time, is that regardless of the amount of infections, what's important for us to know is that are we ready to track if there's 1,000 infections, 10,000 infections, 100,000, 200,000? If that day comes, we've got to make sure that we are capable to do so. And is our system ready for that? The answer is a complete no.
What else will, you know, earlier we talked about cracks that were revealed by the pandemic. So as we open up now, what other cracks are you worried about? All right, Dr. Farhan, we'll try to get you back on the line. Your line seems to be a little bit poor.
Yeah, let's talk about that, you know, that comment that he made earlier on that, you know, at some point, we are not ready to welcome outsider, and we're definitely not ready to welcome outsider who's going to infect our local populations. However, the two counter argument that I think a lot of people will put forward. Number one, this Omicron wave seems to be perceived by everyone else and evidently seen to show that decoupling effect of infection number and people who ended up in ICU. So that's a reason why most countries have that confidence of relaxing their border restrictions. On the other hand, is that a lot of the countries, many countries, are more readily bulking up their healthcare system anyway. So regardless of what's going to happen, whether we're going to have another wave of mutant COVID or another infection from another source, we should be ready. That's my thinking, that at some point it's going to open. And we didn't see similar destruction in UK and US. Farhan, what do you think about that? My counter-argument to your thing is that your discussion earlier on that we are not ready. Of course, there will be that fear at the back of our mind. But if we look at other countries such as South Africa, such as, they went through that whole wave of infection and then they managed to come out stronger and then so opening their borders. Can we not follow them?
Yes, I think there are good points that we can actually follow. But again, my iteration, as you can see, right, George, I've been cut off the line, I think, multiple times throughout our session today. So even basic communication infrastructure, I mean, if you look at Sabah and Sarawak, if you look at Sempurna, if you look at places like Tawau, You know how my suggestion is supposed to operate. Everything is based on internet connections and everything like that. Even the PKD, which is the health district office, does not have a stable internet connection. You're talking about people who do not have access to certain smartphones, and you don't have, and people who actually do have smartphones there don't have access to internet. So what I'm saying is that as much as we want to move forward and open up our borders as quickly as possible, you have to look at the bigger picture here, right? The tourists that are going to places such as Sempurna, such as Sarawak, because these places are extremely beautiful, but the places that the tourists love to go, most of them do not have a stable internet connection. Mm-hmm. Yet, this is the places that we want to open up to boost up the economy. So the question is, the infrastructure, the basic infrastructure, such as communication, how can we actually open up in a safe manner if we have not addressed these issues? And this is not issues that have been brought up only through the pandemic, but it's been there all this while. It's just that the pandemic now has showed that, you know, these problems exist. So, yes, I agree. We have to open, and we have to open now rather than later. But the question is, are we equipped to open up safely? And my answer to that is, I don't think so.
So, you know, Dr. Farhan, Japan is opening up like in a very limited way. I think they are allowing only a certain number of visitors in a day or something like that. Should we be pilot testing something like that first, do you think? Or was the VTL, for instance, enough to tell us whether we're ready to cope or not?
Well, yes, I think that's a really good argument way to move forward. But as you have to draw on this thing, right? The most of the tourists that come into our country, the bulk or the majority of it is from mainland China. And as you know, China has very strict restrictions about border movement right now. So opening up our borders actually just benefits the Malaysian citizens, actually, because these people, I mean, our people are now able to go out, go on holidays and come back without restrictions, such as my travel pass and all these things. So I think VTLs are a way to move forward. I think we also need to be very aware of bio security, where we have to take these things such as viruses
as a step for us to mitigate the amount of spread that can occur in our country. Because we have to remember that just because we move to endemicity, or just because we use the word endemic, it does not mean we are safe. People love to misinterpret that endemic is safe.
So on that note, what does endemic mean?
Well, endemic basically means it's something that's in our society, such as dengue, for example. So dengue is endemic. So we know that there is a certain level of that disease in our country, and that it plateaus, which means that we accept that there's an X thousand amount of cases that we can accept per year, for example. So COVID, when it's fluctuating in such a manner whereby we hit 30,000, drop to 25, hit back 33. So when it's fluctuating like this, we are nowhere near endemicity, because we have not come to an acceptable level where we say, this is the X amount of cases that we can say that we accepted per day, and this is the X amount of deaths that we accept per day, that we say we are okay with these numbers, and that anything with this number and below is acceptable. Anything above is something to worry about. So I think this is what draws the attention to. People always use this word where it's endemic, and I think a lot of people say, hey, why do you have to do that? It's a kind of endemic, you know, these sort of sentences that hear people use around. But people cannot grasp that endemicity does not mean safety. It just means the virus is here with us. But believe me, even though we are transitioning to endemic, or we touch endemic, there are still people dying at home. They're still brought in dead to the hospital. People are still on ventilators, and we're still recording high number of cases. So endemic does not mean safe. It just means that now we have to learn how to live with the virus, and we have to learn how to go back to normalcy in the safest manner as possible. So there's a very big gap there when I think a lot of people still have not come to terms with until now. That's my thoughts on it, George. What about you?
Well, it's difficult to highlight that. I mean, we have a listeners out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have a WhatsApp message that came in, and it ties so nicely with what you're talking about, Dr. Farhan, about not equating endemicity with the idea of it being harmless, because our listener is comparing the pandemic to the Y2K scare. If you remember that there were a lot of warnings that it would completely disrupt our digital and computer systems because of Y2K. And consequently, he says, our listener says, nothing actually happened because of that. So he's saying that with COVID-19, we get sick, but we get well. And moving forward, he believes we should just open the borders as long as you wear your mask when you're in crowded places. Is that what do you... Perhaps, Dr. Farhan, is that one measure to living with COVID-19?
Is that good enough?
Well, I think we have to come to terms with COVID. I think this is something where everybody needs to accept that COVID is here and it's likely to stay with us for the rest of our lives. And yet, at the same time, we don't want to be too restrictive in what we do. I think masking, regardless whether COVID is here or not, should be the way, because I think if you see the statistics, once we have actually used masks, I think we've seen a drop in the number of influenza. I think the GPs have also seen a drop in the number of cold cases. So I think masking is actually a way to go, especially when you're in indoor spaces with no proper ventilation or poorly ventilated areas. I think that's the way masking should go. But for me, if it's open air, open space, I think you should assess the risk. Yeah, picnics, barbecues by the beach and all those things, you don't need masks to do that. And I think that's very well for us to open up. And I think that measure is... I think that is the only measure that we should be moving towards.
You won't believe it. Xiao Wei and I are both wearing masks in this studio at the moment. Of course, we're listening to your advice. The only sadness I have is that I don't get to see her smile.
Well,
I think she'll get to send you a selfie later.
That's right.
We are in the very definition of a poorly ventilated space, a soundproofed radio studio. What other measures will be important to live with COVID, Dr. Farhan?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, I'm more of a proponent of just masking. I don't think social distancing actually works now, because we know that the gaps does not play an important role right now as much as it used to, especially with Omicron. I think if you have social distancing and you don't wear a mask, you're still highly transmissible. But if you wear a mask, and I know that people don't actually measure 1 meter, 1.5 meters, and so on. So I think masking, and we know that the masks are allowing people to now no longer have any gaps and separations. But I think the protocols, such as ensuring that you cover yourself, I think this is a very good protocol. But I think the second thing that we have to actually empower people is this. If you are sick, if you have any signs of symptoms, you have fever, cough, flu, and all these things, you should stay at home. And I think this is what we should be telling our people, is that if you're unwell, you should stay home. And I think with these two measures, I think we can move forward as normal. And I don't think we need anything else.
What about testing, Dr. Farhan?
Well, I think testing should only be done when people actually have symptoms. Because right now, a lot of people love to test. But you also have to understand that there's such a thing as unnecessary testing. So I think people must know that if they have just gotten COVID and they have recovered, that within the first 2 months, it's pointless for you to test, especially for PCR, because it can still pick up the remnants of the virus. Mm-hmm. At the same time, if you keep testing without the need to test, at times you have to understand that the test kits also are influenced by pH levels of your saliva. So it may give you a negative result, a false positive result, for example. So I think it's critically clear here that people with symptoms, and if you're fully vaccinated, should only test when they have symptoms. If you are asymptomatic and you're fully vaccinated and boosted, you should be all right. So I don't think you should be too aggressive on this front.
So you don't support, you don't support an approach many people are using in, in a lot of social gathering now, or even in certain companies, before they actually visit the company or visit the home, just do the self-test kit, take a picture, WhatsApp to each other, and making sure that, we have that degree of comfort when we, are close to each other. Do you think that is complete nonsense, or do you think there's some sort of values in that?
Well, I think there's two points on this, George. If you look at it, right, if you go to a social gathering and they practice what you are practicing in the studio now, such as masking, keeping yourself just a few feet apart, I don't think those testing is necessary. I don't know whether you tested yourself prior to coming into the studio.
Well, he absolutely had to send the results to us, which is why he's bringing it up.
With the time and date stated at least 2 hours beforehand. And I feel comfortable with that, because, the last thing I want to be doing is kind of like infect the whole studio of nice people on BFM with my disease. However, to me, I have no idea what is the validity of such thing, and then how much longer do we need to practice such measure?
Well, there's 147 kits, I think, as of what we are talking about, that has been approved by the MDA. And I think, I'm sure you've seen the social media posts whereby they've tested 10 kits, 6 show up positive, 4 show up negative. So I think there's a lot of questionable integrity in the test kit itself. I think another issue that we have to address is that a lot of social gatherings, especially when we talk about movements of people in crowded places, actually involve a lot of this lower socioeconomic group. And I think that it is important for us to address that it actually costs them money to do this type of testing. Mm. So if you're unable to enforce it, if you're unable to enforce, I think it should not be mandatory.
It's okay. I'll get BFM to reimburse me.
because if you look at it, right, a lot of times people who actually fail to understand the reason for masking, the reason to keep themselves apart, are usually people in the socioeconomic tier, in the lower socioeconomic tier, and this has been shown. And people who are in the high economic tier, usually they make sure that they wear masks, such as yourselves. You keep yourselves apart, and you take the extra step of making sure that you do an RTK testing. So we've seen a lot of cases where people actually lie on the RTK test. They actually just take pictures from somebody else, or they just recycle pictures. So this actually happens, and it even happens in nurseries for kids. And when you go and ask them, why did they do this? They said that, look, it cost me $6 to $10 to buy a test kit every single week. Yeah. I have to buy 2 test kits a week. That's $100. I only make $800. So you're asking me to give up 1/8 of my pay for this. Definitely I can't afford it. So there's a lot of issues that needs to be addressed. So for me, you can't enforce it. You can't do it. So just go with the notion of, if you're if you're asymptomatic, you're fully vaccinated and boosted, you should not test yourself unless it's completely necessary.
Mm-hmm. All right. You know, we'll go for a quick break now and we'll come back and look at a few other things that we need to keep our eye on. Vaccinations, one of them. And, you know, you wanted to talk a little bit about nightclubs, Dr. Farhan, and I think that's important because measures that affect an entire sector, an entire industry, have to be backed by science. I mean, this is what this whole show is about. You know, we are a science-based show. Public health measures should be science-based approaches. I want to get your thoughts on that. Workplace measures as well when we come back. So I'm speaking today to, well, my co-host is in the studio with me, Dr. George Lee, and we are speaking to Associate Professor Dr. Farhan Rusli, Public Health Medicine Specialist, on the 2 years after MCO, are we ready to transition into endemicity? WhatsApp was your thoughts, 018-789-8899. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao Ik, and my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. We're speaking to Assistant Professor Dr. Farhan Rusli, Public Health Medicine Specialist. We're looking at what we've learned 2 years after the first movement control order was declared. And are we ready to transition into COVID-19 becoming endemic? You know, one very important point Dr. Farhan has made is that endemic doesn't mean it's harmless. You know, many other diseases are endemic in our population. Dengue, tuberculosis, for instance. Endemicity, as Dr. Farhan has explained, means that the number of cases are stable at a certain level. They're acceptable in terms of our healthcare capacities, ability to a healthcare system's capacity and ability to manage the diseases. It doesn't mean that a disease becomes harmless just because it is declared to be endemic in our population. So one of the things that stood out, Dr. Farhan, when the new measures come April 1st were announced, is that almost all sectors are opened. Borders will be opened. But one omission was nightclubs, which will not be allowed to open yet. Your thoughts on this? Because and I'm not just asking this because nightclubs per se, but there could be other decisions where we see... We need to see where is the science when these decisions are being made.
Well, I think on this note, right, I have to make an open declaration that I don't own any nightclubs, so I'm not proposing or proponing any of the sectors here.
Noted.
You have to look at this, right? Let's say you have a kanduri. We'll go very, very simple on this, right? A kanduri where you have perhaps a nikah solemnization ceremony. So definitely you invite, 40 people closest to you, and I guarantee you most of them don't wear masks, right? So what's the difference between that and a nightclub? Are you saying that you want to prevent certain outbreaks? I think if you're already pushing towards transitioning to endemicity, what you should look at is, could you actually enforce a rule whereby prior to entering such a place such as a nightclub, should you do an RTK test right there, and then they get to go in? And then that sector can operate as what it was. Because now you have to look at it in that sense. What are you trying to say? Are you trying to say that you only can get a cluster of outbreaks if it's a nightclub? What about if it's a concert? What about if it's a political ceramah or a political session? Does that not also give a high number of transmissibility around? So you can actually enforce, if you want to go clubbing, you have to wear masks. For example, there's no smoking, so it doesn't require you to open up your mask because restaurants actually allow you to open up your mask. Are you saying that if you eat in a restaurant and you sit next to a table, that there's no way you can get infected? I think this is why a lot of issues need to be based on science, on scientific data, not based on political alienations, not based on populist movements. And I think if we start going down this road, my fear is this. People will start questioning the measures that we are putting in place. And they start questioning whether it's actually real or not real. And that's my fear at all. Mm.
All right. We have a question here from Subra, who's asking, you know, vaccinations of kids below 11 is still low. Schools are opening. Could this result in increase of cases with the kids transmitting to, adults in their household and especially the elderly?
Great question, Subra.
Well, I mean, Shai, I think you know that I've said this so many times. I have always said that the opening of schools should always be in parallel and in tandem with vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
We should vaccinate the 12-year-old, and then the 11-year-old, and then the 10-year-old, 9-year-old, 8-year-old. So you open up from darjah 6, darjah 5, darjah 4, darjah 3, and so on. And you'll get to a point where all the people who go to school are actually fully vaccinated. And this is what I've been saying for so many months, because we've seen that vaccination actually improves outcome. It actually reduces transmission. It actually prevents clusters. And if even though you get infected, you actually reduce the amount of symptoms or your severity of disease. So up until today, I really have no idea why they do not want to do it in tandem or in parallel. I don't understand why is there the necessity for them to rush when you know that you can actually mandate it. And another thing that I want to point out is that if you've made it or you've transferred teachers who refuse to get vaccination from teaching in the classrooms, what is your policy when students refuse to get vaccinated? Are they going to be allowed into schools, or are they going to be told to stay home? So do you see? You see, we are in a paradox where it's very difficult for them to tackle policies that they have actually instilled, and now they're going to change it because it serves a different population. And this is tying back to what I said in the beginning, whereby a clear policy that's based on science and data and not based on populist thinking or popularity should be the way for us to move forward. Then we can actually exit the pandemic in the safest manner possible.
So is there a rationale? Are you advocating for mandating vaccinations for school-going children?
Yes, I absolutely believe so, because I think that it's unfair to allow people who've actually taken their kids and who've been responsible and gotten them vaccinated, and they actually are now in jeopardy because of other kids who refuse to get vaccination. And this is not something new. If you look at how we've actually done so, when you want to go enroll your kids into preschool, they will actually look at your immunization card. Mm-hmm. So it's not something where it's totally mm-hmm. radical or something that is absolutely new or such a breakthrough.
So if you mandate,
whether you have practical will.
Yeah, so if you mandate that, how do you answer your own question earlier on for people who refused it? Are they excluded and discriminated against further education?
Well, I think this is the biggest thing, or the biggest issue on policy, because we've already sidelined teachers who refuse vaccination and transferred them to all the other places except for teaching, and that's already been done. Mm-hmm. So my question is, if you don't do it for students, is there a double standard? I mean, do you actually say that kids, the school children are more important than the teachers? What is the message that you're trying to push out? And this is why I say that you cannot be strict on one hand and then be lenient on the other hand. You cannot just say because the kids need education that you can just forego this. Because the teachers also can say that, look, I'm the one who's giving out the education. If you can forego the children, why can't I be allowed that same exemption? So it creates a very big hole that you are unable to fill. You will never be able to satisfy if you don't take a stand. Are you going to be a hard stand, or are you going to be on a lenient stand?
Well, you know, you're talking about using the stick versus the carrot, but do you think that we could do more to incentivize and encourage parents to get their kids vaccinated?
Well, I think absolutely. I think we've never done nearly enough. I think very early on, George actually pointed out how much we've actually not invested in our public health programs. And I think this is what is the result out of this, is because people start questioning our public health measures. People don't trust the public health messages that we're trying to give. So what this shows is that definitely we have to go on the ground. We have to convince over and over again. And we can't expect to be turning minds of people in just 1 month or 2 months. It takes years for it to happen. And if it does take that long, so be it. Because that's long game. It's not that about enforcing something and expecting results in 2 or 3 weeks. Definitely, we have to invest more. We have to do more. I don't see ministers going to the ground, going to houses, talking to people. Can you actually get yourself vaccinated? Are your children vaccinated? But yet, you see them doing so when it's about political votes. They go house to house.
I think
why can't they go house to house and ask them?
We can accept that politicians have certain ways of doing things, Dr. Farhan. But very quickly, moving away from schools, workplaces, you know, this whole notion of transitioning into endemicity is in line with a lot of workplaces requiring employees to come back to offices. What kind of measures would you recommend to ensure workplaces are safe?
Well, I think number one, if your office has functioned really well for the past 2 years and majority of your workers have worked from home and they've actually come up with the same amount of output, I think you should just leave them at home. I mean, it saves you electricity, it saves you water, you don't have to stock up the pantry. I mean, you have to think about the plus one.
And we saved the traffic jam from KL, right? No traffic jam in KL.
Exactly, George. I love those days. All right. And then number two, if you have to come to your office, make sure that the time in the office is actually utilized really well. So we have to move away from hours spent in office to output of office work. I think those two things are very, very different. I can spend 8 hours in the office doing nothing, or I can spend an hour at home being really productive. I mean, those are two things that you have to look at. All number right. three, I think you have to look at the ventilation aspect, which means that you have to ensure that you have good and proper ventilation, the in and out. You have to have an air quality specialist to come and measure. It's not only for COVID, but it's also for everything else. And I think that you have to keep your workplaces safe. And just because you can't see air doesn't mean that you should not address it. And I mean, those are the top three things, I guess.
All right. We're going to have to wrap up now. I'll just get final thoughts from you, Dr. Farhan. Ready to transition into endemicity?
Absolutely not.
he's even less of an optimist than I am. Okay, a bit of clarification on that. Then, what at least top two things we need to do?
We have to make sure that our public health infrastructure is extremely ready, and number two, we have to make sure that in the case of the blowout where there's severe outbreaks in high number of cases, that our clinical parameters are actually prepared to take in all those number of patients. And we have to remember that the variants do not end with Omicron. We may face something which is much more deadlier than Delta, and we have to make sure that we're prepared for it, regardless whether we're open or not open.
George, final thoughts?
Well, my two take home from this conversation, actually, number one, I totally agree that looking back, we underinvested in healthcare. I think the way forward is to invest more in healthcare. And then also the second thing is invest more in your own health in a micro level so that people will be healthier, whatever diseases you face in the future. The three things that we talked about in terms of facing endemicity, number one is school, number two is borders, number three is the workplace. My thought is that in life, the only certainty is uncertainty. So only time can actually shroud away that cloud of uncertainty. So let's find out what we'll do in 2 years from today, what that cloud will disperse that uncertainty.
They also say taxes are the one certainty in life. So
and death.
Tax season is coming around, guys.
Yes.
But thank you so much for your thoughts. Assistant Professor Dr. Farhan Rusli, Public Health Medicine Specialist, and my co-host, Dr. George Lee, for our Doctor in the House segment. This has been Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.